This is Tom Rowe, and you have tuned in to Turn on the News, Free 103.9's nightly or daily look at radio art, radio news, and more. And we've got a special edition today, all about low power FM and the Federal Communications Commission. Federal Communications Commission has just released new rules for the low-power FM service that's going to be unveiled later in the year. There's going to be an application window likely in September or October. We're going to look into all aspects of it tonight. And lots of background. We've got lots of historical interviews that led us to this point in time. We're going to explain it all for you, all the details of the FCC's new LPFM rules on today's edition of Turn on the News. Things in slightly different order tonight on Turn on the News. I'm going to start with today in radio history, and behind us the Mr. Rogers theme. He would have been 84 today. On this day in 1922, KGWAM in Portland, Oregon began broadcasting. In 1924, on this day, WJZAM New York City became the first station to broadcast a foreign language show. Not sure what it was, it doesn't say here. We're looking at radio at .about.com. On this day in 1948, Stop the Music debuted on the ABC radio network, starring Burt Parks. And in 1995, the city of New York sold the two radio stations it owned, WNYC AM and FM, back to the stations they own. And now they sold off the classical station from New York Times in that deal. And the classical station is no more. It got since traded off to New Jersey to a smaller license, but that's how things go.
Won't you be my neighbor? Won't you please? Won't you please? Please won't you be my neighbor?
All right, this is Tom Rowe with Turn on the News. And tonight we're going to look at the LPFM, low power FM, and what happened today at the what the Federal Communications Commission has just announced. Radio Inc. magazine has the details of the Federal Communications Commission's two orders to implement the Local Community Radio Act. The FCC release says, quote, "The items help promote community radio through the licensing of low-power FM, LPFM, and FM translator stations, advancing the Local Community Radio Act and commission goal of fostering localism and diversity in the radio landscape," unquote. And others weighed in, quote, "We are pleased that the FCC has taken such a careful approach to preserving channels for community radio," unquote, said Brandy Doyle, policy director for the Prometheus Radio Project, a Philadelphia-based lobbying group for community radio. Quote, "And we're particularly glad that the FCC has taken our recommendation to ensure that the frequencies set aside are in populated areas where they are needed. This will make a big difference in San Antonio, Sacramento, and 12 other mid-sized markets where stations too far from the city would have reached only tumbleweeds or farmland," unquote. So we'll have lots more details about this throughout the course of the show. But let's get a little overview from Vanessa Graber from Prometheus Radio Project. She was on WGXC recently, and here's an excerpt of an interview, and she explained the process that led to where we are today.
So Vanessa, we have been, those of us who are kind of plugged into the radio radio buzz have heard about a little bit about the March 21st meeting that's coming up at the FCC and the application window that they're expected to announce. Can you explain it to us in sort of layman's terms?
Yeah, so I will give you a little bit of history for all the listeners out there that maybe might not know about the Local Community Radio Act and how it's affected the rulemaking at the FCC. In 2000, that was the first time the FCC licensed low-power FM station, and about 860 or so licenses were given out. After that, the Radio Preservation Act was passed, and that essentially limited the FCC from being able to license any more low-power stations. As a result of that act, which was mainly passed by big broadcasters and their lobby group, the National Association of Broadcasters, because they claimed that these little low-power stations interfered with their signal. So the FCC commissioned a study, about $2 million, called a MITRE study, and they concluded that there were no real interference issues with these LPFM. So the road was sort of cleared for the FCC to license more stations. But we needed to pass new legislation to repeal the Radio Preservation Act, and it took us 10 years to do that. And finally, in 2010, in January of last year, Obama signed the Local Community Radio Act into law, which it repeals the Radio Preservation Act and mandates the FCC to expand the low-power FM radio program. And it also allows stations to be on the third adjacent channel. So essentially, stations are allowed to be spaced closer together. And in order to expand the LPFM program, the FCC had to resolve the translator issue. Translators are devices that repeat the signal of a larger station. So many NPR stations, for example, will rebroadcast their content using a translator. And 2002, over 2,000 of these applications were filed, and the FCC froze them as a result of their advocacy. That is, it didn't process them until we figured out the LPFM issue. Now that we have the Local Community Radio Act, they're able to make a decision on what they're going to do with those translator applications. And the Prometheus Radio Project, along with a coalition of other organizations and grassroots organizers, has petitioned the FCC during the last commenting period, which was in the fall, to leave those spaces on the spectrum open for LPFM rather than translators. So they're expected to announce their decision on March 21st.
So here we are. And that all doesn't sound very controversial, but actually it was at one time. Not in the too distant past. We'll go back to, say, the early 1990s. And at that point, there was a weird catch-22 with Federal Communications Commission's law. You could be a big giant station and broadcast thousands and thousands and thousands of watts and cost a lot of money to get on the air. But you couldn't be a little station. There were a few grandfathered in 10-watt educational stations, mostly at colleges and high schools, but there were no regulations to apply for a 100-watt station or a small station like that to reach just a highly concentrated population area where there was certainly space on the dial for such. And to prove that, thousands and thousands of folks went on the air in acts of civil disobedience during the 90s to show that there was space on the dial and there was community interest in broadcasting and filling in those gaps on the dial that were clearly available. As far back as 1998, at a National Association of Broadcasters conference, we have some audio of someone speaking about the possible engineering ways of getting more voices on the air.
There is, of course, no question that these stations are violating the law. I think one of the traditional methods of challenging a law is to violate the law and take it to court. And that appears to be what Mr. Dunifer has done. I have not heard exactly how the FCC has answered the constitutional questions, other than saying the Supreme Court has said through the years that there is no constitutional right to turn on a transmitter. It does appear that there could, in the spectrum allocation process, be a couple of channels set aside for unlicensed use with FCC-approved transmitters on a non-interfering basis, sort of an expansion of Part 15. Another area is this, as Mr. Ruck mentioned, the elimination of Class D stations and the lack of local origination on FM translators. And I'm wondering if these FCC prohibitions are the least restrictive method of serving a legitimate government interest, which I think is the First Amendment question Mr. Dunfer is pushing.
Mr. Dunfer, that the speaker was referring to, is Stephen Dunfer. He started Free Radio Berkeley, a pirate radio station, micro radio station, he soon started calling it, in the early 1990s. He was upset about the mainstream media's lack of coverage of the first Gulf War and set up his own broadcast station in Berkeley and then began making small, cheap kits for building transmitters and making them available around the world. And several thousand micro radio stations soon sprung up in his wake. He was sort of the Johnny Appleseed of the movement, which became more and more political and was being waged not just in the civil disobedience front, but Mr. Dunfer won an 18-month stay that was allowed to broadcast on the air from Judge Claudia Wilkin in 1997, which emboldened even more micro-radio advocates across the country to take to the airwaves. It's Mojo Nixon in the background. All these stations were committing civil disobedience, and then the court started ruling in their favor, and the media began painting very positive features about stations that when the commercial station in town stopped airing the town meeting, the pirate radio station would air it. Or the station when there was a flood was the only station in town that was live and local, not the commercial stations, was the pirate station that you could call and the mayor was on the line explaining what to do in San Marcos, Texas. So this was happening all over the country, and then pop stars like Mojo Nixon and John Hyatt start writing songs in favor of these kind of actions, and Stephen Dunfer eventually created some demands. We're having lots of fun. Sing!
I am 8 years old. We basically have called for a mass micropower turn-on to occur on the first anniversary of the LPFM ruling, which is January 20th, if I remember correctly, by the Federal Communications Commission. So we're basically now putting out an official call as a micropower action coalition for mass turn-on of micropower stations on January 20th. And we will do a special web feed that we hope everyone across the country will carry so we can show our power as a, at the very least, a national, if not international, network of micropower stations. And to that end, and consistent with the principle that the right to communicate is a human right, and that intervention in the exercise of this right by any entity, government, corporate, otherwise, is untenable. We also are making the following demands as the Micropower Action Coalition. These demands are, first demand is a demand of amnesty for all micro broadcasters so that all of them are eligible to apply for an LPM license if they so choose to do so. Second demand is to set aside TV Channel 6 at the bottom of the FM band as expanded FM coverage and assign that those three new channels to a micropower service only. Third demand is to eliminate the ban against second adjacent channel spacing under the current LPFM. We demand that any further encroachment on the analog FM band by digital broadcasting be immediately stopped, and that digital broadcasting should follow the European standard of Eureka and occur in a totally different band of the spectrum, and the analog FM broadcast band be left alone as is. Next demand is to drop ownership caps and reduce them to pre-96 Telecommunication Act levels to prohibit any further sales of spectrum by either licensees or the FCC. We also demand free airtime for all political candidates and an end to the relationship that allows broadcasters to fulfill certain obligations by broadcasting messages or programs that promote a particular viewpoint or policy of the federal government. Next, we also demand an end to U.S. government-sponsored, either directly or indirectly, broadcast directed against Cuba. And finally, we demand that the sovereign rights of Native indigenous peoples to freely broadcast on their lands without government sanction or control.
So I think he got 1.5 of his demands met by the Federal Communications Commission yesterday. That was Stephen Dunifer from Free Radio Berkeley, a micro radio station from the mid-90s till now, and who's been a long advocate for people having access to their own airwaves. This is John Hyatt with Pirate Radio behind us. So Mr. Dunifer there was demanding a set of demands after the federal government had already caved in to some extent to the civil disobedience of the pirate radio stations across the country, and was considering and had considered a first early version of low-power FM legalization. It was a tough fight, and it sounds like an easy to understand situation. I'll explain the demands that he named that he won were the allowing low-power FM on second adjacent frequencies. Previously, they were only allowed on third adjacent frequencies, which means that if you're broadcasting on, say, 90.7 FM, the first adjacent frequency is 90.5, and nobody's supposed to be on that. The second adjacent is 90.3. That's the second adjacent frequency. And 90.7, a full-power station, 90.3, a full-power station can coexist, but an LPFM, a tiny 10-watt or 100-watt station, is not allowed to be that close to a big station. It has to be three away. This ruling today eliminates that, and means that the low power stations, obviously, that don't interfere with the big stations, obviously can be as close together, which will allow more stations. So one of Mr. Dunifer's demands there, and the last thing he said was about indigenous people. There is something in the ruling, and I'll try to dig it out here, that addresses that indigenous Native Americans can apply for these low power FM stations for their on their land. So he may have gotten two demands. I'll look at it more closely. This is Tom Rowe with Turn on the News, and we have a special edition tonight just looking at the Federal Communications Commission's decision announced yesterday about low-power FM and their expected window for folks to apply for apply to get their own low-power FM station later this year. We were explaining the process that we got to, and so the first step in about 2000, the Congress passed the first low-power local community radio act, and it had that second adjacent frequency law because the National Association of Broadcasters they created all sorts of lies about low-power FM and saying that it was going to interfere with big giant stations. These tiny, tiny stations were going to interfere with big giant stations. That was their big, big argument. This is the CD that they sent to senators and House representatives across the country explaining what the interference would sound like if low-power FM stations would be allowed on the air. This is what low-power FM stations would be allowed if they were allowed to go on the air, which is, you know, currently the case, this is what the radio dial was going to sound like. The National Broadcasters sent this CD to senators and congressmen back in the year 2000.
This is Chuck Jackson. I'm an electrical engineer with my own firm, JTC. I have experience at the FCC and have worked for more than 30 years in the electronics and communications industry. I earned my PhD in electrical engineering at MIT. I was retained by the NAB to do an independent analysis of the four studies of FM receiver performance that were before the FCC as part of the low-power FM rulemaking. I prepared this CD at the NAB's request. The CD demonstrates the technical standards the FCC used in its recent rulemaking on low-power FM stations. Specifically, the CD illustrates the impact of the changes in the existing interference protection standard that radio listeners currently enjoy. We digitally recorded the over-the-air radio signals of five popular stations in the Washington area. We then electronically added the types of interference that we project would be heard by listeners if new LPFM stations are licensed in this market. The levels of interference that we have added have been deemed by the Commission in its report and order to be acceptable to consumers. Said another way, the Commission feels that consumers would judge these modified radio station signals to be, quote, adequate, unquote, after the addition of these new interference levels. The interference we use is technically called crosstalk. In practical terms, crosstalk means you can hear the audio from another station in the background of the desired station. The first two levels of impairment or interference that we demonstrate are levels that the FCC's Office of Engineering and Technology classified as acceptable to listeners. The third and most extreme example of interference was deemed acceptable by the National Lawyers Guild study, a study on which the FCC relied in its final report and order. Here is a brief cut from WAMU, a public broadcasting affiliate in Washington, D.C., run by American University. This was recorded off-air using a good-quality consumer radio and illustrates the sound quality currently enjoyed by its listeners.
Complete listing of open jams is on the hotline. The hotline is open anytime you call, 202-885-1234 or 1-800-525-8338. Or you could visit our homepage at www.wamu.org.
Here is the radio station you just heard, but now with crosstalk at the level that would push performance of a Sony Walkman to the FCC's 1% test level. This 1% level is substantially better than the level the FCC deems the limit of consumer acceptance. The FCC says that this is the level of interference at which, quote, most listeners would not be able to perceive any degradation. See if you agree.
Complete listing of open jams is on the hotline. The hotline is open anytime you call, 202-885-1234 or 1-800-525-8338. Or you can visit our homepage at www.wamu.org.
So that was later revealed to be a complete hoax and lies from the National Association of Broadcasters. And anyone who's listened to the dial since low-power FM has been in effect knows that that's not what radio stations sound like. And that this claim that tiny 10 or 100-watt stations are going to affect 50,000-watt stations like that is amazingly surreal. So we'll go to the real engineers and see what yesterday's announcement from the Federal Communication Commission means. Paul Thurst at Engineering Radio says the announcement, the FCC has more or less stuck with its plan to keep a minimum number of LPFM channels available in the top 150 markets. This also includes a 50 application limit for the country and no more than one application per market per applicant. When conflicts occur, translator applicants get the chance to demonstrate how their application would not preclude LPFM opportunities, unquote. Quote, modifies eventually eliminates the May 1st, 2009 cutout date for cross-service AM to FM translators. Quote, a new LPFM allocations are established under the criteria of disregarding the third adjacent channel contours. We mentioned that before. FCC added, quote, more stringent requirements for local programming and ownership, especially as a determining factor for mutual LPFM applications. Quote, allows LPFM stations to own translators, unquote. Quote, new class of LPFM is established, the LP250. 250-watt LPFM stations are designed mainly for areas outside of top 50 markets or for previously licensed LP100 stations that want to upgrade, provided the minimum separation contours are met with existing stations, unquote. So that's one radio engineer, licensed radio engineer's opinion of this week's announcement from the Federal Communication about new applications will be accepted soon for low-power stations across the country. Paul Rimsmondale at Radio Survivor weighs in with all sorts of interesting observations on this. Quote, one of the main challenges facing the FCC is the backlog of 6,500 applications for FM translator repeater stations. Because of the relaxed spacing requirements enacted by the Local Community Radio Act, many of these translator applications would compete for spaces on the dial that would otherwise be suitable for new low-power FM community stations. While the Commission will proceed with reviewing these translator applications before accepting new LPFM apps, in its fourth order report and order, the Commission sets forth procedures to ensure that frequencies appropriate for LPFM stations remain, especially in densely populated urban areas that are underserved by existing broadcast media. The Commission explicitly acknowledges that the next licensing window for LPFM, quote, presents a critical and indeed possibly a last opportunity to nurture and promote a community radio service that can respond to unmet listener needs and underserved communities in many urban areas, unquote. At the same time, the FCC finds that since translator stations have more flexible licensing standards than the next LPFM licensing round, quote, will have only a modest impact on licensing opportunities for future translator stations, unquote. Therefore, the Commission is favoring the licensing of LPFM stations because they are, quote, uniquely positioned to meet local needs, particularly in areas of higher population density where LPFM service is practical and sustainable. However, in a nod to the National Association of Broadcasters, the FCC also agrees to give current translator applicants in these so-called spectrum-limited markets the opportunity to demonstrate that their applications would not preclude any LPFM opportunities if granted. The Commission will allow these applicants one opportunity to make minor changes to their applications in order to meet this requirement. From Radio Inc., their version of the details of the fourth report and order sets forth a revised spectrum availability analysis that better identifies and protects areas with significant populations where LPFM service is more practical and sustainable. It gives translator applicants proposing to serve spectrum-limited areas an ability to demonstrate that their applications, if granted, would not preclude certain identified LPFM opportunities. It adopts a national cap of 50 applications and a market-based cap of one application per applicant per market for the most spectrum-limited markets, minimizing the potential for speculative licensing conduct, and modifies the May 1st, 2009 date restriction to allow pending FM translator applications that are subsequently granted to be used cross-service translators. Rimsdale at Radio Survivor also says, quote, a suggestion that is likely to draw criticism from many LPFM advocates is one to permit the cross-ownership of an LPFM station with translator stations. This proposal seems like the Commission's attempt to throw a bone to the large religious broadcasters who rely on large chains of translator stations to rebroadcast the programming of a main full-power station in their order to create a nationwide network on the cheap. These broadcasters are likely to be unhappy with the FCC's decision to give LPFM stations priority, and so it seems that this is an attempt to mollify them by letting them get into the LPFM game and potentially reclaim some of their lost frequencies. Or quote lost. The adoption of such a rule would have a significant effect on competition for LPFM licenses, since these non-commercial religious translators are often applied for by local groups that have no formal connections to the broadcaster that originates the signal being rebroadcast. If LPFM translator cross-ownership were permitted, there would be a sudden influx of dozens, if not hundreds, of applicants that would otherwise be ineligible for an LPFM license. My concern would be about these groups' intention and the ability to actually produce and broadcast locally originated programming, since translators explicitly do not air such programs. That's why translators are attracted to these groups, making the cost and complication for owning and operating them relatively minimal for local groups. However, an LPFM with 8 or more hours of local programming a day is much more involved endeavor, and these same groups may not actually be able to maintain if they even have a real intention to do so in the first place. But of course, the Commission will be accepting public comments on these proposals, and I'm certain that LPFM advocates, the broadcast industry, NPR, and religious broadcasters won't hesitate to weigh in. A 5-day window for LPFM applications is expected to be announced for September or October. Go to newsroom.free103.9.org for more information about all of this. There's links to the Radio Inc. story, the Radio Survivor story, and the Radio Engineering blog item too, and more at newsroom.free103.9.org.